Setting up shop.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Setting Up Shop, the podcast where we do our best to impart what little wisdom we have to help you as small business owners, makers who wish to sell their things, to have a bit more advice, really, and a bit more choice, a bit more understanding about some of the options available to you. I'm the main host. My name's Dan. I'm a wood turner from England. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Rasmus, a blacksmith from Norway, and Heidi, a potter from America.
Howdy.
Hello.
Is that the traditional Norwegian greeting? I thought it was something a bit more violent.
Yeah, but then I will max out the mic and it doesn't sound good.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. That's not a problem at all. I'm just going to move my meeting notes over to the other side of my screen and then we can carry on. Right, there we are. All very technical. So today's episode, we thought we would talk about wholesale or no sale. What would you do if approached and asked, do you wholesale your goods?
It sounds so aggressive. Wholesale or no sale. It could be
wholesale
like
or no sale.
Wholesale or no sale. What's your choice?
Oh, yeah, it is a choice. So we're going to start off, I suppose, by defining this. It's always good. We're not going to turn up the dictionary. We'll turn to the Setting Up Shop dictionary, which is Heidi. If you could, for us, clarify the difference between wholesale and consignment.
So it's a really simple difference, really. Wholesale is I'm going to take your product for a certain price, and I'm going to take this quantity, and I own it. After you've handed it off to me, it's mine to do with however way that our contract dictates. Consignment, however, you still own the product and they're taking a percentage because they are acting as the seller, but they don't own the product. So at any point you can pull your product back and say, you know what? I need inventory for my shop. I need to sell it, which, you know, this isn't really relationship building if you do that. But the consignment side is more what you would see from a gallery, what you would see more from a small mom and pop kind of space where they just have tables that they have a bunch of different local goods on the tables. Wholesale is more something that ends up happening from corporate entities. It happens from coffee shops. It happens from gift shops and things from maybe like a hospital or something similar, or even like a, I don't know, some area that is a tourist area, but they're really involved in like the local craftsmanship. So you've got consignment, which is one thing, but today we're going to really focus on wholesale. Is it for you? What does it mean? And how do I price for profit when it comes to wholesale?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting thing because wholesale really is certainly one of the challenges that Rasmus and I, when I went over to Norway and we went to the stand there, that one of the main sort of aims of that, correct me if I'm wrong, Rasmus, was to try and find wholesale customers in a way, wasn't it? Or places that would stock it. And I think it was an eye-opener for both of us, which was part of the reason for doing it. And also very interesting in the following months where I was very focused on would in future my products be wholesalable? If they were, what would be required, certainly in the United Kingdom? And I think a couple of points I want to touch on there. One is, which was really interesting, you mentioned about the contract. So it's really important, whichever way you do it, wholesale or consignment, that have something in writing. It doesn't have to necessarily be a fully signed up contract, dependent on what value you're talking about. But at bare minimum, write out in an email a conversation you guys have had and make sure the person responds to, yes, that's what we agreed. Because it just makes things a lot easier. It makes people feel a lot more comfortable knowing that you're both on the same page and all of that kind of good stuff. Because I, in the past, entered into a wholesale situation where I was requested to make 40 of a certain product. They agreed a price. I said the price. That was fine. And in my head, I was working on them working on a 40% increase for them to cover. So they would make 40% profit and charge tax on top. And then when they put my product in their shop, they added 100%. And I hadn't had that conversation with them. I'd explained to them what the recommended retail price was. Now, in America, this would be a bigger deal, if I remember rightly, but in the UK, not so much. So in the UK, we have specific laws that state that you are not allowed to wholesale, as the manufacturer, we are not allowed to wholesale a product to someone and tell them how much they have to sell it at. We have fair competition on price laws, which means that basically you can pick and choose what you sell your product to a company or a shop for, but they get the choice to sell it. If they want to sell it for a penny over the cost price, that's up to them. If they want to triple the value of it, that's up to them. And you might say, oh, but that's fine, Dan, because you got paid for the goods. I did, but they then struggled to sell the goods. They had ordered 40 of one product and they were trying to sell it for more than I retail it for on my website, which was already, for a bespoke item, not cheap. And so consequently, I've never had a repeat order from that company because, as far as they're concerned, his product doesn't sell. So it's not just about making sure that you've got the, you're all on the same page as much as it is, hey, is this going to be a good relationship? It's the first step in building the idea I would, most of us would assume would be a long-term relationship that's going to generate revenue for both parties. But circling back then, Rasmus, what do you do if you're asked, do you wholesale?
So I say yes, I do. And I have actually, since January, gotten two inquiries for wholesaling things. One of them has currently only been on consignment, but the initial conversation was about consignment now, but wholesale, if this works out. But also because we did that market in January, granted, none of the two leads I got, none of the two wholesale agreements I have now, or I'm working on now, are from that market. But that market enabled me and gave me the framework to look at and understand how wholesale works. Granted, you can say that was kind of an expensive lesson.
Yeah.
But then again, I got to try it, and I also did it with the full understanding that nothing might come of this. And also, I don't have time to do this market again until the next year anyway. Mm. So I have a whole year to look at things and consider, do I want this more? I also know a couple of the museums that we talked about back then. I haven't followed up with them, but I have gotten a couple of other cross leads to that. Like, we're doing the Maker Faire at one of the big libraries in Oslo. One of them were interested in my products. When I'm now helping out with the Maker Faire, I will go in there and I have a conversation with them again and say, hey, I think I talked to some of you guys back then. Like, can we restart a conversation? Is there something concrete that is preventing you? I also recently taught a class where a woman booked a 6-person birthday class one day with me, where they make a project together. All of them work together as conservators at the Cultural History Museum here in Oslo.
Excellent.
And they also told me that recently they actually had an open position for someone who's doing product development internally for them. And they had seen my things. They now like me. They wanted to put me in touch with them. So there are things in the background that has come from this because it has prepared me for these other conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's always important. You don't know where a conversation is going to lead or what that relationship is going to end up meaning in the future, which is why it's always a good thing to be nice and to be polite. And to, there's no such thing as a second time to make a first impression. So, make sure that your first impression is good. Even if the person is stood in front of you on a rainy day at a craft fair, you've sold nothing, you're miserable, and the guys come along or the girls come along and they've got a dog and it's just weed on the corner of your tent. You got to remember, you don't know who that person is. And as best as possible, even in the most negative of times, they may lead to something else. Mm. It's definitely good to hear that despite the lack of follow-up from them or for yourself, from that matter, from both sides for that event. I think for myself and yourself, Raz, the main thing we realized from that event was people who want to wholesale fall into two categories. The ones like the museum, in your case, the ones like the museums and the libraries and stuff, who they want a locally made thing that's nice, that will make them a bit of money for their shop and continue on their sort of that element. And you've got the other group of people who want to make 100% profit on everything. They're not overly worried if the quality is consistent because they're probably not going to stock the same item continuously all the time. they want the next thing and the new thing and the adaptation of the thing. Have you got it in color? Have you got a different color? Have you, you know, can you do it slightly differently? Can you put our name on it? And they're a lot more mercenary, and they want to, you know, and we'll talk a little bit later about quantities and all of that kind of stuff. Heidi, do you even wholesale, bro?
Do I even wholesale? It's the primary function of my business now. I did the market, the farmer's market, the, you know, local goods market for a few years. And I've really stepped back a lot from that. Mainly, pottery isn't something that's really easy. And Rasmus, you can probably speak to this too. Like, when you have a product that's super heavy,
yep,
and bulky, it's a wear and tear on your body to like set up your booth, tear down your booth, reset your quantity of items, make sure that you have it where it needs to be. And my view was, it's really super taxing. I don't want to spend the money to hire somebody to do it because I want to pay a livable wage and I want to be able to offer benefits. And with only doing a couple of markets lately, the quantity of items that I've been able to sell doesn't really allow for that. However, with the review of wholesale, so there's a sticker shock, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we're talking about like the, like figuring out your wholesale price versus your retail. There is an initial sticker shock, and it's hefty because you're used to going to markets and selling things direct to customers. But you have to keep in mind, like specifically for me, I had to keep in mind that I didn't have a storefront, number one. So there's a lot of expenses with having your own storefront. With consignment, if I were doing consignment with a shop, then I might only get 40% of my markup value, depending on my contract. And even then, I'm responsible to make sure that my products sell. And then looking at the expense of even just renting a space at a farmer's market, like it's gone up astronomical to have table space. When I compare that, and you can make charts and things and compare it, but for me personally, the biggest place where I'm going to see growth in the next 5 years is going to be wholesale and lessons. That's going to be where my focus is on my business. It allows me to be in my shop more than I am customer facing, which I prefer. But also, it allows me the comfort of knowing that I have bulk orders that fill my kiln. So when I want to do a one-off project, my kiln's already filled and I don't have to make a bunch of not necessary things that I don't know are going to sell. And I'm not tasked with having to sell them because with wholesale, like I said before, when someone wholesales with you, they are responsible for offloading that product. It is not your responsibility. Rasmus was saying, and Dan was also talking about like, okay, well, once it's in their hands, like if they aren't responsible with how they are reselling it, it may assume that, oh, well, I can't sell your product. Having those conversations up front to say like, hey, I've had success with X, Y, and Z, therefore my product goes really well. I see that in your store, you are selling X, Y, and Z for 15, 20% more than what I'm selling for. If your goal is to offload as much as possible, you will go with what I've investigated in my market, what my value is for my product, and you'll use my pricing. In the US, it's called suggested retail price. That does not lock them into selling it at that price point, so they can sell it for less and take a loss, or they can sell it for more and potentially hold on to more stock so that their shelves are fuller. Not really my gig. My biggest thing is I don't want to compete with you. Like if I have a shop too, as a wholesaler, if I have a shop too and I'm selling a like for like product and you're overpricing it and I'm selling out of it because I'm a lower price point, well, shame on you. If you're selling it for less than the retail value and it's directly competing with my prices, we might have an issue because of my contract negotiation, right? So I may not sell to you based on this. So my position as a maker is I do better with wholesale. Number one, because I'm a potter and I need to fill my kiln. Number two, because I hate markets. I hate what it does to my body. I hate how tired I am. I would rather just package everything in a box and hand it to somebody.
Yeah.
It's just, it's my business model now. And it's been for probably the last year, I would say.
Yeah. And it's been successful for you. So why wouldn't you pursue that? But I think, like we've said, if you've not done it, and then someone just randomly comes up to you and asks, hey, would you make 50 of these a month or whatever, put you on the spot like that's a very difficult question to answer, because obviously your brain goes, yes, I will, no problem at all. I am an overly cautious person, as many friends will attest, in the sense that it will take me sometimes a couple of years to commit to a thing that I've been pondering. Well, I've mentioned that before. The podcast took over a year before I approached you guys. But equally, I think in that particular instance, it's wise to consider the things that Heidi have said and say, well, where's your shop? What are you selling? Like, what else are you currently selling? Do you even have a shop? Are you just, you know, are you someone who sells from your home and you just sell through a website and you're expecting me to do all the shipping? Are you expecting me to drop ship for you? Because that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
Very briefly, for those of you who don't know, dropship would be when someone sells products they don't physically have, and when the order comes through, they send it to you and ask you to send it direct to their customer. So you do all of the work physical. They theoretically do all of the digital work to try and get your product in front of customers and sell things. We're not talking about that today. So it's worth, you need to have that investigative conversation outside of the environment you're then currently in. Like, you're at a craft market, you have a focus. This is great. I'm really interested. This isn't a no. Can we set up a meeting? Can I come and visit you at the workplace and we can have a conversation? Because the other thing being as well, whilst with the best will in the world, you only ever work with people you like. Sometimes there are people who offer you a good opportunity. It's not that you dislike them, but you wouldn't go and have a beer with them after work. So, like, you know, there is a work relationship and you can have a perfectly acceptable work relationship with each other and both make some money as a business. And, you know, without you having to then go and socialize with them, it's important to remember that the levels of not everyone's going to be your friend and it's not necessarily personal. Mm. So it's, you can business. Have a good relationship that's polite and nice, but it is a business relationship and you don't have to know everything about their family and their pets and all of that kind of stuff. Sorry, Raz, you had a point?
Sort of on, I think Heidi briefly touched upon it, like the sticker shock of wholesaling. You can also turn it around the other way and try to figure out what is the current cost per sale you have.
Mm.
How much time do you spend with each customer before you close a deal? How much time do you spend packaging an order before it and going to the post office and shipping it out and figuring out all of those things and realizing that, okay, giving X number of percentage and handing over a lot of items at once means that I am actually able to make more money. Because not only do I spend less time per item sold, I'm also freeing up more time in the workshop to produce more.
Exactly.
And you also have the benefit of then actually having a sudden influx of cash again that you can reinvest either in yourself or the business and keep the business growing. Like, yeah, it's fantastic to have items on the shelf, sitting there waiting for someone to come and want them. But it can be even more important to have money in your bank account so you can buy the new tool, the next thing that will make your business operate smoother.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because cash flow, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, for yeah. sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something I keep thinking about. Like, not only do I need to have a certain amount of markup on every single item so that I have a profit margin, there needs to be a certain amount of margin on everything because it needs to also account for the cost of me not producing something when I try to sell this.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind too, is that when you're evaluating it, it isn't in this or that. You can do wholesale and retail yourself. So you don't have to do what I did and quit markets. Yeah. You can still sell at markets and do wholesale and do consign. You can do all three if you wanted. Oh, it's a little bit more complex, but you can certainly do all three. It's just like, what is your business model? It goes back to episode one. What is your business model? What are you chasing? What is your product? What can you do? What's your capacity? And
why are you doing it?
Why are you doing it?
What exactly do you want from it? Because like you said, you can do all three. I would stress that if you want to do all three, great. I hope you're organized. I hope you've got a good log. Because the individual clients might be a lot more forgiving than those who are wholesale clients. Because if you tell them it will be 2 weeks and then 3 weeks later you've not started and you've not given them an update, that can be problematic. So it can be a more serious business relationship, but that shouldn't be something to make you scared or put you off from doing it. Because as we were just hinting at or we were dancing around a little bit, was cash flow. So today I've shipped a second order of a part to a potter. He's asking me to make some wooden lids for something, ironically, Heidi, making lids for other people,
not
for my own products. It's great. and it's, so that's not wholesaling because that's manufacturing a part for someone, but it's the second order I've had for them. And I was saying to the guys before I started that technically I'm not making as much money as I would be if I was selling it myself individually. So it's a diameter bigger than my large breadboards that I make. And there's a couple of extra bits of process. So it takes slightly longer to make them one of my large breadboards, but using the same timber. But I am selling them per piece to the person for £18 less than my breadboards would be. And you look at it and you go, oh, that's quite a lot of profit difference. But my large breadboards this year, I have sold 2.
Mm.
Whereas so far of this other product, the guy has had 14 from me in 2 months. So for the sake of not having that higher profit margin, but it's a product that I don't make to sell myself, it's just for him. I'm still making money. I'm still factoring in paying myself, paying all of my costs. And for the product and everything else, I'm taking a smaller profit margin, but I have cash flow. And I've had a repeat order, and hopefully I will continue to having repeat orders until he decides to discontinue that product. And that would be great. That would be fine. So if your business will only survive if you have the regular cash flow. And that, interestingly enough, that whole connection came about because I left some products on sale or return or consignment with a couple who do outdoor dining events at their home. They have a large old barn that they have dressed up, and at one end they have the kitchen and you have one long table, and they have a section that is a shop. Mm-hmm. And November last year, I brought some of my stuff along and said, hey, look, here's some of my plates, here's some of my boards and corkscrews and other stuff. They've not sold any of my stuff at all. Like, it's not sold. People have looked at it and said, oh, yeah, that's nice. But the potter who's had this business from me came to one of the meals and saw them and said, who made those?
Mm.
Because I've got a project that I need someone to do. And so my details got passed along because of those products. And that's come back to me. Now, it's up to me. I could have at any point gone back in and, as you've explained, change over the products or just taken them out. Oh, I've not sold any, then this is a waste of time. But because I've left them there, it created a talking point that has led to other business. So it enabled the cash flow to happen, which, as Rasmus would say, buys more toys.
Tools. I said tools.
Oh, sorry. Tools. Yes. Yeah. it's very difficult to hear his accent.
His accent.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's so nice, but nobody understands it.
So what we need to bear in mind then whilst we're talking about money is look at your margins. Does wholesaling make sense after you've looked at your margins? Because if you're working on a low margin already, if you're not confident about putting your price up, if you're looking at your thing and saying, oh, well, no one will buy it for X amount of money, so I'll sell it at this price, and you're making, let's say, 20%, which is very small, unless you've got a really high turnover, you're stacking them high and selling it cheap, as it were, that's going to be difficult to really increase that price over time. And then if someone comes to you and says, oh, will you do wholesale? If you're only working on 20%, I would argue the answer is no. Because realistically, I don't know about you two guys, but if someone was asking me to wholesale, and we'll talk about minimum order quantity in a minute, but let's say that they had a minimum order quantity of 100 per unit or something, the lowest I would be looking at being willing to take would be 20% per item, if they're placing in a sizable order with me. That's me personally. You guys might have a different figure. So you know, that's a conversation, but you need to make sure, does it make sense after you've looked at your margins? And as Rasmus said, you need to include, you look at it two ways. Okay, so what am I gaining from this versus what am I not having to do by getting this order? Is it going to take you 2 or 3 weeks to fulfill that order? And that means that any regular customers or regular markets won't have stock. You need to bear all of that kind of stuff in mind. Plan it out. You know, there's no problem saying to the person at the end of the conversation, okay, I have taken all this on board. Give me a couple of weeks. I will get back to you by X date, and write it all out and work out timescales. How long would it take you per item to make, and, you know, the costs and all that kind of stuff. Because if they're a business owner, then they should respect that and understand that, you know, you need to make an educated decision before you can give them a response. Does that sound fair?
Yeah.
Okay, then. Minimum order quantities, MOQ, is the short term that some of you may not have heard before, business speak, MOQs. I made a common mistake with this, and Rasmus and I had this in front of us at the show in January. I made a common mistake, which was to say, if you buy 1 to 10, it's this price. If you buy 11 to 20, it's this price, and broke it down like that, right? And you would think that, oh, okay, well, I, as a shop, I'm only going to buy 20 at a time, so this is the price I pay. The honest answer is, if you show anyone that you can sell it for a cheaper price, even if it means that they're supposed to buy 100 of them, they will be less likely to buy unless they can have that cheaper price. Even though they can only afford 20, they want the cheapest price. Everyone will always want the cheapest price available. So I would recommend that you don't offer a scale of prices to anyone who asks you if you wholesale. I would suggest that you say to people, what sort of quantities were you thinking of buying? Because if they come back and say 10 at a time, then you give them the 10 at a time scale price. If they say, can you do any better? Then you say, yeah, sure, if you buy 50, you know, and then if they haggle in between, then you say, oh, okay, fine. Well, here's the 25 price or whatever. And then they're more likely to buy in. I don't know if that sounds about right to you, Heidi. But I wouldn't jump in and say, here's the 100 price right from the get-go, because you'll find people will rapidly back off and either say, oh, we can't take 100, or they'll try and get the 100 price for 25 at a time. So yeah, I mean, does that meet the experience of you guys? How would you feel on that?
If I can shoot in something, sort of just on the whole haggling side of it. If you start by giving them the best price that you can, and they want to try, then they might want to try to immediately try to get a better price, because some cultures live in a system where the first price you give is kind of the fuck-off price, and you're supposed to haggle from there. That's like in Western Europe, in America, I don't think that's as common, but a lot of people still have that mindset of saying like, no, this is the normal price you're giving me. What's the best you can do? What's the best you can do? Come on. But if you then start also by saying like, oh yeah, you might be looking at 20 of something. Here's the 10x price, or the price for 10 items. And if they say, okay, that's fine, wonderful. If they then haggle with you, you still have the margins to actually treat with them. And you both can go away from that conversation and feel like it went okay. They might manage to haggle the price down a little bit, and you still kept to your formula.
Yep.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It really does. And to be honest, like for me, it's more the mom and pop shops that end up trying to like get you down in price or whatever versus the corporations. Corporations are used to dealing with MOQs on a daily basis, especially like they're ordering toilet paper at an MOQ, you know, like mom and pop shops are just going to Giant Eagle or whatever store they have around. And like, that's a local colloquialism. I'm sorry. So they're just going to their grocery and they're picking up the toilet paper that they need at retail price. They're not buying it wholesale. So you have to understand who your client is. And I think Rasmus is making a really great point about like what the culture of your client is if you're doing international sales. But if you are within your own market, if you're locally selling wholesale, it gets less complex because you know what your culture is.
I wouldn't even say like internationally, just inside of Norway, there are certain fjords that are a bit more stingy than others. Oh,
these,
yeah.
These folks, these Norwegians, tell you what.
I mean, Heidi, I know. I mean, there's a north-south divide in the UK. It's well known that certain parts of the UK culture are also going to be a bit tighter with money than others. There's going to be the same in the US. Don't tell me there's not. There's going to be certain parts, even within your own state. I bet there's some people who are known.
Oh, for sure,
like,
within my own state. When I look at corporate culture, corporate culture is a lot different. So if your client is corporate based, they're used to a certain way of doing business.
Yeah.
Especially if they're in an international business. Local, you've got to be a little bit more, oh, hey, how's your dog kind of attitude? Like, how's Susie doing? You know, you're building those kind of relationships. You're building those local ties and that networking, which is like really, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I think if you're serving your community with your product and you're saying like, I'm making this because I want to carry on the tradition of this pastime, which, I mean, I feel that way. I don't know if you guys do. Yeah. I want to ingrain a passion for pottery in my local community so people can grow and learn and do it, along with helping local coffee shops, local gift shops sell a product that talks to my community. It's been the heartbeat of my business, and it's been the best resource for me as a potter and as a business owner to tap into the local market versus I think what we were doing with Slap Stuff Together, where we were trying to be more, maybe too broad.
Yeah.
And as soon as we started paring it back and identifying that our local community actually was the place to be, the people that were going to support us through good times and bad times, it was much easier to look at, okay, well, what does our pricing need to be to sell locally? What wholesale opportunities do I have locally? When you start looking at an insular level, then you can build your business a little bit more on a better foundation where you can go, okay, so these local chains are here. For me, it's, I mean, I keep saying coffee shops, like obviously you guys are probably not selling in coffee shops, but like, mugs and coffee, we kind of are like symbiotic. So when I start looking at what else is around me outside of coffee shops, it's hospitals, it's corporations that are looking for gift giving opportunities to give to their constituents. It's opportunities for local politics. I've been doing things. I don't care if you're one side or the other side, you're left or you're right, and you come to me and you say you want something made. Yeah. I mean,
are you paying me? Yeah.
Green is green, right? Well, not in some countries. In the US, you give me the greenbacks and I'm good. But then you start looking at, okay, what if a corporate organization is coming to you for a certain number, then it starts to expand where you're like, oh,
yeah.
Can I meet that minimum order quantity? Can I meet the demand? And that's where it can sometimes get a little sticky, whether if you're a one-man show.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's quite interesting, actually, because the can you meet the demand question is going to be different for each of us. I mean, Heidi, you mentioned earlier, obviously, you've got to fill the kiln. You've got to fire the kiln. But it's not just you've got to fill the kiln, but actually sometimes the demand is so high that you need to now do two kiln loads, and obviously there's a whole once it's in there, you've got to just wait. There is nothing else you can do to that stuff in the kiln until it is finished firing. So yeah, you can go, you can carry on, and you can make some more the next batch or whatever, but you can't do anything else, you know. Whereas Rasmus and myself, that there isn't that part of the process necessarily where it's okay, that's now dormant over here for X period of time following a process. Every single thing is just stack up and move. And being able to meet the demand, this will sound stupid, and this is something that a lot of people don't think about, is space. Okay, if you've got to make 200 of X widget, whatever it is, and that X widget you're used to making 5 of, and it's got that little space on your workbench, well, that's where the 5 of those go. Well, now you need 4 times the amount of space for that, so that you know, right, that's all done, I've achieved those. But also you then need the packaging. you need to know that that box is now, well, actually you need a box four times the size, or you need four of the little box and all of that kind of thing. And then whilst you're making them, let's say it goes even higher and someone orders 500 of that, well, you've got to store all of that and you've got to make sure it's in a part of the workshop where it's not going to get damaged. It's not going to get dirty, or you know, if it's a finished product, if this is like, you know, you've applied the finish, the polish, the, you know, whatever it is you've done to it, you've got to make sure that nothing happens to it whilst your normal working days are going on. I mean, Raz, you know, you could be running a course in the middle of doing batch work. That means you've got to stop. You've got to reorganize your workshop in an entirely different way, move a load of stuff around and make sure that nothing gets damaged. Or the person on the course coming in doesn't go, oh, that's really nice, can I buy three of those? Which, let's be honest, you don't turn down the money. Because you know, if they're going to give you the money there and you're like, well, I haven't branded it yet with the other person's price. Yeah, sure, I'll sell you three of those at $5 above the price of what I'm selling it to the corporation for. Fantastic. And then you've got to make three more. You know, all of these things, it's not an on-off switch. If you're trying to run as a business, you need to have everything going at once, because you need, going back to the cash flow, if someone orders 500 of an item and you calculate out, okay, that's going to take me 2 to 3 weeks, whatever the price point is, that's 2 to 3 weeks where you are not making other sales unless you've got stock that sat on the shelf that can be sold.
Good point. Yeah.
Because if you've got stock on the shelf that can be sold and you've got that in a separate building or a room of your house, as is most often the case, and that's selling on Etsy or wherever, or you're going to a craft show to do it or sending someone else to do that, that's fine. But if you haven't got that other stock available and you've gone all in on this 500 order, you're not earning until you get paid. And one of our friends who shall remain nameless has very recently made a very, very bespoke thing for a company and gone to deliver it. And then they've told that person, yeah, but you're not going to get paid for at least 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's another thing to be aware of. I'm not trying to scare everyone. Just bear in mind, I wouldn't recommend going, oh, well, I've got an order for 500 widgets, I'll get paid in 3 weeks' time. If you're delivering to a big corporation, they normally like to not pay until the end of the month.
Net 60.
Okay, sometimes. Net 60. Yeah. So again, that contract at the beginning, before anything starts getting produced, before you've bought the materials, if you need to buy them, all that kind of stuff needs to be ironed out beforehand. So both parties are aware, everything's fine and going forward.
Yeah.
So meeting demand. I mean, Raz, I witnessed you shut someone down very quickly when they asked on the roses, oh, can you 100x these very rapidly, blah blah blah, you know, and you were like, no. End of conversation. Yeah. You know, it wasn't, oh, I could, you know, it wasn't dollar signs or euro signs for you. It was, no, this is not capable, I can't meet that demand.
And that was an easy one. Granted, still since then I have devised up some ways of making them quicker and faster, but more importantly, making them in a way where it doesn't require so much physically out of my body to do the roses, because texturing them, especially the stainless ones, is an absolute bitch. And it will hurt my hand doing more than five in a day.
Yeah.
And I can power through, I can do a lot more, but if I want to make these consistently over time, especially if I have a large order, my routine is, when I need to rush this, I make five today, five tomorrow, five the next day. And I can do that for a week or two and be fine. If I try to do 20 in a day, I can't do five the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. So that it's really important, isn't it? Can you meet the demand? Can you meet the demand on your body physically? You've both mentioned that, you know, any craft will have a demand physically on your body. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's crocheting right the way through to the heavier stuff that some of us are doing, there will be a demand on your body. You know, joints will ache, all of this kind of stuff. And it's not just an age thing, I hope. It's, you know, can we meet the demand? So it's definitely something to bear in mind. And, you know, on our next point on there is, you know, how would you or do you work with larger corporations? Because if you worked with a larger corporation, you've got to bear in mind some of the things we've already said about payment and everything else. But Heidi, you brought up a point about insurance.
Yeah, and I learned this probably in the last 3 years, is that corporations, when they are bringing on a vendor, they treat every vendor equally. Whether or not you are a large conglomerate where you're making you know, $10 million a year, or you're only making $20,000 a year. They require the same level of liability coverage as anybody, because they want to make sure that their consumers are covered and that they're not liable for your defaultive product. And I only really experienced that with going with a corporation that was much larger than a local scale. So this is like a corporation that works, it's all domestic, like United States domestic, but they service all 50 states. And so their requirements from a legal standpoint, and I understand it, it makes complete sense, is that they treated me the same way that they would treat any like other retailer, like a North Face, which is globally known, or a Patagonia clothing company or whatever. And it makes sense because they're trying to cover any risk management, right? So my deductible to be able to be in the store equaled the same as these large conglomerates, which was a $2 million deductible.
Yeah.
Most US-based insurance companies start off with a $1 million deductible if you're in store. They also do like different things, like if you're just doing trade shows and those things, to cover you for, you know, loss prevention and, you know, natural disasters, like windstorm comes and takes your tent away. But when it comes to these large corporations that have to cover themselves, a lot of them are starting to look at if there is a lawsuit and there are damages that need to be paid. We don't want to incur those damages. We want to pass them on to our retailer who sold us the goods. So you need to be covered, even if it's a fraudulent, frivolous lawsuit. You need to make sure that you're protecting yourself as somebody that's giving consumer goods. And most of us are doing consumer goods, whether or not that they are put in people's mouths or whatever, they are something that a consumer is interacting with. Unfortunately, you know, people can get a splinter and they end up with like having to have their arm chopped off. Like that's an extreme situation, but these corporations are looking at that as a risk component. Yep. And they want to make sure that they are safeguarded from a giant lawsuit because your product cut them. Whether it's a manufacturing thing or whatever, I don't want to scare anybody either, but in the sense that a lot of areas are litigious, specifically America is a very litigious society because our healthcare system isn't exactly set up in a way that helps people more than tries to like take a lot of money from people. You have to be litigious because you can't cover your arm getting cut off because you got a splinter from a piece of wood that you bought from a vendor at, you know, Costco or whatever. You're going to go after Costco, and then Costco is going to go after you as the vendor who provided that item if you're not completely covered. So those are the things that you have to be, aside from the demand, because they're going to ask for larger quantities than you may be able to be able to produce as an individual. That doesn't mean that you can't offer your product to those larger conglomerates. You might have to take a step back and say, is it worth it?
Yeah.
Was the product development the part that I really liked, and I can hand off the manufacturing to somebody? If that is the case, like, I learned probably in the last 2 years that if something of mine blew up and became this hot market item, say on Twitter or on Instagram or on TikTok, I have resources within my community that I can reach out and say, can somebody help me make a mass quantity of this?
Yeah.
Now that's me taking a back seat to producing it myself.
Yeah.
And I have to feel good about doing that. Like, I designed the product. Do my fingers have to touch every single one, or am I okay handing that off to a manufacturer? It's your decision. We're not saying like your decision is bad. If you decide to do that, if you decide to mass produce, there are avenues that are available for you. If you have a product that it's taking off, or you have a design, or you have a concept, there are facilities that are built around this entrepreneurial space. And you have to remember that, like, me as a person, I built my business because I wanted to make the thing.
Yeah.
Some people build their business because they like the ideation and the product development. If you are okay with handing off the manufacturing, like, sounds like Rasmus, you weren't when they came to you with that number. If you are okay with it, there are resources available. And I'm sure in most countries, there's a lot of spaces where like small business development is a real key thing.
Yeah.
Mostly in towns that have universities, I've found. There's a lot of grant money in the United States for small businesses. A lot of, and I don't want to get into politics, but a lot of people in politics really like to prop up the word small business.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurship. And it doesn't matter what country, because it's a nice little like middle class thing to be like, you can be your own boss and we're going to throw money at you. So there are programs in just about every country to be able to establish that. Sometimes it's called something like micro transactional opportunities.
Yeah.
You'll see that in like third world countries where there's micro loans available to small business owners that help prop up their communities. There's other regional grants. And I don't, maybe it's a different term in your countries.
No, grants is correct. Yeah.
In our country, in our specific region, because we're in Appalachia and they want to make sure like our economy in this area goes from like some like middle class to poverty line and more poverty line than anything. So there are a lot of grants in this region to help prop up small businesses who then in turn employ some of the people in the community to make deliveries, to work in the shops, to do different things. There's a region in Galveston, Tennessee, that is Dolly Parton actually puts a lot of money into in the Pigeon Forge and Galveston area. It's a huge tourist trap, but the economy is specifically driven towards small business owners, people that make cowboy hats, people that make cowboy boots, people that do pottery, people that do woodcraft, people that do masonry, people that do blacksmithing. It's how their whole economy is propped up.
Yeah.
So if you start looking at those different things, yes, you might take a loss wholesale, comparatively speaking to your retail, but those situations in those communities allow for you to tell your story about your product and you to build your business with the money that the government is providing. And it's not welfare. It's small business initiative.
I think it's a very important thing. And because it's only something I'm recently becoming aware of, there's a couple of grants that I theoretically could have applied for this year and I didn't, because I didn't feel that, as I'm not really manufacturing much this year, that I justified it. But I haven't looked too deeply into those. And I think all of us make an assumption of certainly a lot of us, if you're like me, what's the point of applying? There'll be thousands of people who apply and, you know, my chances aren't very high, da, 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 da. And the answer is, if you don't apply, then you will never get the money. But if you do apply, you don't know how many people are applying or what the requirements are that might mean that you get it.
I know for here in Norway, there's a fair amount of highly specific grants that are actually struggling to have people apply to them.
Yeah.
And I believe that's the same more or less all over the world, where you have some kind of foundation. They just, their mandate is to give away this amount of money to anyone who qualifies per year. And it's only in a sort of a diligent application process if they have more applicants than they have spots to fill.
I was told a year ago that I would be an ideal candidate and genuinely like a shoo-in candidate for a scheme that is being run by a particular group, which gives you a free workspace, a decent-sized workspace to produce whatever you're going to produce that is made out of wood, preferably a wood turner, for a year. And as part of that agreement, once a week on the Monday, you are given small business training. They check up on you. They say, right, so what are you making? How are you doing it? Why are you doing it like this? Let's talk you through how to price, how to, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it's in London.
Yeah.
And they don't pay you. You have to make it work. So if it hadn't been in London, which, you know, I would have had to have found accommodation in London. I would have to have basically said to my wife, do you fancy, like, if I just come home at weekends or... You know, how do you make that work as a married person with a home, with a mortgage and everything else? Couldn't walk away from the job that pays that. So there are definitely, as you said, Rasmus, really specific things around available. More often than not as well, the people who have those are really bad at marketing and really bad at telling people they exist, which is why they're not taken up very often. So the final thing really to cover on all of this is, who are likely clients for wholesale? If this sort of thing appeals to you and you don't want to wait for the magic moment where someone might approach you at a craft store and say, oh, would you, you know, be willing to wholesale all these goods? Obviously, this is going to be really individual, really specific, depending on what each of us make. Rasmus makes a broad range of things from, you know, sort of garden specific stuff to tool specific stuff and all that kind of thing. Heidi is a little bit more specific, a little bit more of a narrow focus, which has proved to be very beneficial, I would imagine, because as you've said in the past, you've chosen the t-shirt of pottery because everyone wants a mug, and then everyone wants another two mugs, and then maybe three more for friends. So it's, you know, as mentioned earlier, coffee shops are kind of a really obvious place in some respects for Heidi to potentially try that product. Whereas for Rasmus and for myself, who sell a broader range of things, where would you, you know, you don't want to just start knocking on doors or randomly posting out, hey, here's my catalog, or emailing people. How do you find those likely clients, and what would you do to set out to do that? Heidi, I'm going to defer back to you again, if that's okay, because you've got more experience in this field.
So taking my potter hat off and putting on my merchandising hat, I think the biggest thing is that you want to pursue clients that align with your convictions, number one, because that will immediately create a solid relationship and a good foundation. If your goals are to sell as much product as you possibly can, then someone like a Costco or a Walmart is your target corporation or wholesale target. If you are more interested in passing along the craftsmanship and the story that you're trying to bring, and you want your clientele to be part of your story, then being more insular and focusing on local sales and local opportunities to partner with people that have a similar mindset. And Rasmus, you can talk a little bit about this with like the historical society. If that is your goal if you think about yourself as an organization, then you're going to want to pursue those opportunities with wholesale. If you don't know what your vision is for your business, we're not holding it against you. Sometimes by like casting a line into different avenues, which is what I did, casting a line into different avenues and seeing what works for you as an individual is completely okay. And Dan, you're completely okay to not have a plan. I know it irks you. So when I first started, I was just like, my goal wasn't necessarily for my pottery. It was to prove to my husband how to sell a product. Then it was, oh, I have way too much pottery in my cupboards. What do I do with this? And then organically, I got reached out to, Love Pittsburgh, who I've talked about a lot. They reached out to me, said like, we really like partnering with local women makers. We have this vision. Are you on board? We'll help you develop a product if you'll develop maybe five for us, and we'll wholesale it. Not everybody gets that opportunity, but like I was saying with the grants and those kind of things, partnering with people that are writing the grants, and you don't have to write the grants yourself. But really, when it comes down to the clients for wholesale, you're looking at entities that are looking for a mass quantity. For me, I need to fill my kiln to be able to hit a minimum quantity. I at least need to fill it by half. So I said my minimum quantity is, my MOQ is at least 20 units. It can be mix and match. You don't have to buy 20 of the same thing. So if you're a little small like gift shop and you're like, well, I want some candle holders, but I also want some mugs, and I only have this amount of money to spend this month.
Yeah.
I'm willing to negotiate with you just as long as that my minimum is met. However, sometimes it comes up where some people are like, they're short the minimum. So you can negotiate with them, because if you are in a situation where it's not some giant corporation and it's a mom and pop shop, you've got one coffee shop that says, I just want something to fill out my shelves. So I only need to order 10. I know your minimum quantity is 20. I don't have a timeline in mind. another coffee shop says the same thing, you can combine those orders and give both of them what they need, right?
Yeah.
You can be strategic. You don't have to make a hard line in the sand about your MOQ. You can pivot and make a change as you get orders. But if you're looking at corporations as your wholesale opportunity, it's not just retailers that are going to resell your items. It's people that are looking for corporate gifts. It's a big opportunity. It's people that multi-sell homes, right? Like they want to sell, they want to give something to their client that just bought a multi-million dollar home in a housing plan. So they're looking for home goods. They might want something from you, Dan.
Yeah.
They might want like a gift basket that Dan, you then reach out to Rasmus and say like, hey, can we do a partnership? What are your wholesales? Can I purchase from you or can we go in this together and create a gift basket for a corporate gifting opportunity because we're local or, you know, whatever the theme of that corporate gift is.
Yeah.
So it doesn't always have to be your MOQs. It doesn't always have to be what the person coming to you asking for something is. You can be in a space where you can negotiate. And as long as it meets what you need financially to pay your rent, to buy your materials, to pay yourself, there's no loss in that. Money is money.
Absolutely. You sparked off a couple of separate ideas that we'll now have to talk about outside the podcast.
Sorry.
I'm going to make a final point here, which should have really come back under the sort of things you need to bear in mind when certainly to selling to large corporations and some shops as well. Currently, I don't package any of my goods to hang on a shelf because why would I? But if you're selling to large shops and corporations, some of them will want that. They will want a hangable packaging. Some of them will want you to barcode your products or at least have a code that they can then create a barcode for to put it on. For certain things like mine, if I've got a finish on a piece of wood, a barcode sticky label isn't always going to be the best thing to go on it and it might come off and whatever. So that's something that you want to have a negotiation with conversation about because it might mean that you create a place on a piece where this is where the barcode goes so that everyone knows and it's easy to see and repeatable. With my other hat on, as a person who works in a retail environment, we get approached by companies saying, hey, we sell wood screws and we'd like you to stock our product. And we look through the catalog and say, no thanks. And they say, oh, is there nothing in there you like? We say, there are three items in there that we like. And they say, oh, that's great because, you know, you only have to spend £100 for free shipping or something like that. We still won't stock it because it's a specific brand. And on our shop, in our shop, we don't have stands that are mix and match brands. We have a meter stand that is all one brand. So if all you've got is three items, we're not going to put it on the shelf. We're not going to have it in the shop. And so you may even find some shops will say, do you have enough variety of products or quantity of products that we could fill X space? And if we're going to do that, the expectation can be, as I would have as a person coming, you know, a manufacturer coming to me with a thing, is that the manufacturer is then going to provide signage and potentially even the stand free of charge because you are in effect gaining a spot in a shop with your brand name and your products on it. So it's, I'm not saying that that's going to happen every time, but be prepared for that kind of a question of, do you supply point of sale items? Do you supply a stand? Do you have a wider range? Do you have a catalog? All of that kind of stuff. Whilst yes, you are a small business, if you're wanting to go in the wholesale area and you're wanting to play that game, you've got to be prepared for the kind of questions that they would, as Heidi mentioned, ask everyone. You know, big corporation will have a standard set of questions from that person. Either you guys got anything else you want to add on this subject?
Just quickly, if you are wondering if this certain client is right for you and you don't have a purpose or a goal or a set of ethics established for a business, that might be a good point to actually think about that and then see how that client lines up. Because if you are in doubt about a client, there might be a good reason for that. But if you haven't set down any rules for who or what or why you do things, then it might be difficult to define, is it just something weird or is this actually outside of my ethics?
Yeah.
Whatever that might be.
Yeah.
For example, with the guy asking me if I can make 100x the normal amount of roses I do, I was like, no, that's not part of the story I want to tell. Yeah, if you want to hire me as a consultant to develop a product kind of like this, yes, but that's a whole other business.
Yeah.
And that's also not really anything I know anything about, but I could, in theory, teach someone to make this product, but then you would also pay me a lot for that, because then you're taking a market share of what I'm doing, potentially.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, whole lot of conversation about things, but I think it is important to at least define the outer edges of who and what you want to deal with.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for listening. I hope it's been useful. I'm sure it has been, because I've picked up some things and written some notes down there. We hope you are enjoying all of the episodes as usual and sharing them with friends and telling other people about this amazing podcast, about how it's helped your small business and how lots of it is really inspiring. Fantastic if you are. I'm not suggesting you then need to contact us and tell us we're amazing. That would be a little bit too gratuitous.
I'd like it.
I mean, I wouldn't mind.
Amazing how the cultural differences crept in there. The British kind of, oh, no, it's fine. It's only.
Don't tell me I'm good at anything.
So, if you would like to do that, you can find us on setting_up_shop, I think, on Instagram. I should really look at that. We should get better at that. Or you can find us individually, myself on @bevelwoodUK on Instagram. Rasmus is @Lowensmed or Rasmus Lowensteinsgaard, or it's a combination of random vowels and letters and things, and then a picture of him balancing
just
a hammer on his nose.
Just face with a keyboard and press enter and hope I'll show up.
Yeah. It's a bit like the Norwegian Beetlejuice. And Heidi is @WhitehallPottery. Please reach out to us if you've got any further questions. If you want to just shower praise on either of my my colleagues here, my co-hosts.
Yeah, we like it.
Yeah. And or even if, genuinely, if you've got some constructive criticism.
No, we don't like to
discuss. Then that's absolutely fine. All constructive criticism can be sent to Owl's Hat Jack.
He'll
never respond. So that'd be absolutely fine. Thank you very much, everyone. As always, it's been a pleasure chatting to you guys, and I'm sure everyone's enjoyed listening. See you again next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.